The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome to theflypod.com, your source for local and world MP3 audio. I'm your host, John Cutter. Today, we're welcoming Mark A. Tabbert. Mark is the curator of the Masonic and Fraternal Collections at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts. He's also the author of American Freemasons, Three Centuries of Building Communities. He is also the presiding master of Mystic Valley Lodge in Arlington, Massachusetts. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome. Thank you. It's good to be here.
By all means. Well, this has got to be a banner year for you. Not only have you received just glowing reviews from the U.S. News and World Report book section, but you were also featured with your recent book as the cover story of the September issue.
Yes, it was very nice. It was quite a surprise. I know that the reporter who did that interviewed a lot of other people, and he came across my book in the process. It's a good thing, because it comes out of Dan Brown's continual writing and the expectation of Dan Brown's next novel to be about Freemasonry in Washington, D.C. So the book that I started writing 2 years ago came out and is well-timed.
And it really has been a resurgence of interest in Freemasonry in particular from The Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown's books, as well as movies like National Treasure. What exactly is Freemasonry, or is it sometimes simply known as Masonry?
I think Freemasonry is a unique thing, or at least it's categorized as a fraternity, which when you think about different community organizations or different organizations that human beings found, it sits as a fraternity. It has elements of other, you know, more familiar organizations like community service or business associations or charities or even religions or denominations. But Freemasonry is a fraternity, that is an organization for men, for the promotion of a fraternity or brotherly love amongst men, with the specific mission within to encourage better quality men or a higher standard of morality of and the tenets of brotherly love, relief, and truth, those tenets being confirmed and communicated through three initiation rituals to inspire men to live, to be better citizens, better husbands, better fathers, that sort of stuff. So Freemasonry has a lot of elements, and this is a large part of what my book is about, is Freemasonry was created as an original thing in the 1700s, and from that first fraternity, many Masons and other people for the last 275, 300 years have borrowed elements to create other organizations that are now the very fabric of American community life.
But it isn't a religion in per se, even though it refers to the Bible. A Mason doesn't have to be a Christian or a member of any particular faith or sect. Is that right?
Right. Freemasonry's purpose is, again, to unite men of various countries, sects, and opinion who have different faiths and different attitudes and different opinions under the idea of a fellowship, of a universal brotherhood, where you can put aside these sort of differences and find things that are shared in common amongst men. And though Freemasonry has a Masonic Freemasonry has a religious element to it, that is, again, that a book of volume of sacred law or the Bible or whatever sacred book is recognized in the community and amongst the brethren should be on the altar and that no atheist can join, it is not sectarian in that fashion. It does not ask more of a member other than that he holds a belief in a supreme being. And an afterlife, really.
Mm-hmm. With the fact that every detail of the fraternity can be studied in any well-stocked library, the Masonic fraternity is still referred to as a secret society. Why is that?
Well, the term secret society originated in the 1800s, and if you look at a lot of city directories, which is precursor to phone books back in the 1870s, 1880s, they list at the front of these city directories all the various organizations, and the term was just used as secret society. That is, societies, fraternal organizations, or clubs that had secrets, that is, secret rituals or grips, words, and signs to recognize members. That term was an acceptable term in that day, but since the 20th century with sort of the mafia or secret organizations or the underground movement or black market or, you know, communist conspiracies or other kind of conspiracies that exist in the world, terrorist organizations we have today, the term secret society has taken on this evil connotation.
Mm-hmm.
So the term secrecy refers to that those rituals or those things that were done in private in the lodge. Today now we view that as an underground hidden organization, and so the definition of secret society changed with our ongoing 20th century society. But Freemasonry, as you mentioned, nearly all the rituals and certainly the grips and words and what we would consider private or proprietary to the fraternity has been published since the 1720s, so there really isn't any secret. It's a question of people looking for it.
I see. Let's stop for a moment and talk about the symbols and rituals of Freemasonry. What do you think their significance is, especially in a modern world?
Well, I think part of what the fraternity offers and what the symbols try to do, and this has been true for the last 300 years, that society, since the Enlightenment, since the 1600s and the development of overseas colonies and the sort of the shrinking of the world, that is, a greater and greater and rapid means of transportation, communication, migration and emigration and trade, that the world becomes rapidly changing, and questions of morality, questions of spirituality, religion, politics, these sort of things have changed rapidly. Freemasonry symbols are very standard things coming out of stonemasonry, or using stonemason's tools, the level, the square, the plumb, the trowel, the 24-inch gauge. These sort of things are to remind us of very basic principles about how human beings ought to operate in the world. And those symbols are there as very material and real things that convey a greater sense of importance or morality or philosophy to maintain an even course or an even keel through an ever rapidly changing society. And certainly the internet and other international forms of travel, that sort of stuff, is continually changing our society.
Mm-hmm. So the symbolism and the ritual, which is, as you say, matters of privacy within the fraternity as well as being outward signs of identification, are really guides of conduct and of behavior, especially positive conduct and behavior.
Yes, and they are taught through three initiation rituals: the first degree, entered apprentice, second degree, fellowcraft, third degree, master mason. They're taught incrementally to provide a deeper level of understanding. So something, and then you're supposed to add them up to mean something deeper into your own life. So something like the square, which teaches morality, the level to keep teaches equality, and the plumb teaches us rectitude of life, and more especially the compasses, that is, teaches us moderations or to keep our passions within due bounds. Those are all very, very simple principles that one helps us to guide us and through our life and through the journey of being alive as we undertake different roles as we mature, from being, you know, a son to being a father to a husband, a citizen, you know, a businessman or a vocation. But ultimately, these things add up, and the complexity of Freemasonry increases as you go through the degrees. So you move not only to take these very basic principles of how to live, but inspires you to do something greater, not simply just being a good person, but inspires you to be more spiritual in your faith and more charitable in your actions and in your life as a whole.
And apparently the fraternity has been fairly pervasive through society, as a lot of those phrases have worked their way into everyday common speech, as in dealings that are on the square or people who are acting on the level. Those come strictly out of the fraternity, don't they?
Well, I think that hasn't really been fully determined. I think some of those are just part and parcel of the English language. I don't know if they necessarily come out of Freemasonry, but certainly terms like hoodwink, to be hoodwinked or blindfold, may be the third, given somebody the third degree, may be part of that. But certainly a lot of the symbols, a lot of phrases and things that come that are Masonic come out of the fraternity, but Freemasonry also, of course, borrows a lot from the wider popular culture. So there's a lot of crossover, especially in our ritual that was written in the 1700s. Many of the phrases that we use today were common phrases used in the 1700s, and so they sort of cross-pollinate.
Mm-hmm. The subject and the focus of the U.S. News and World Report cover story of your book was Freemasons and the Founding Fathers. What role did Freemasonry play in the founding of the United States?
I think, I think you need to go back to the idea that this is a fraternal organization for men who are seeking neutral ground or convivial places to meet and enjoy each other's company. And they're attracting a certain quality of man or type of man who is usually a gentleman, what we would consider a gentleman, well-educated, well-mannered, fairly affluent. And as the colonies developed in the 1700s, this society of men or these groups of men, that as the upper class and the middle class developed, that is, moving from just subsistence farming or small villages to larger enterprises, Freemasonry established a network of lodges sort of spontaneously up and down the eastern seaboard. Those lodges provided means for men who did travel up and down the seaboard as merchants or politicians to meet other men in those communities. So if somebody traveling from Savannah, Georgia, up to Philadelphia to do trade would meet a lodge in Philadelphia and Boston and New York, etc. So Freemasonry provided a network of exchange of ideas, of news, of commerce, and fellowship, which over a period of time, as the revolution approached, that is, greater and greater friction occurred between the colonies and the English crown, Freemasonry just provided a greater network or a strength to support these kind of organizations towards contemplating a separation from England. But there are many, many other organizations, such as the Sons of Liberty, these sort of things that really provided the political and revolutionary activities. So Freemasonry really didn't have a direct involvement and wasn't part of this sort of conspiracy to perpetuate a revolution, but it certainly provided the means for men of different political persuasions and from different parts of the country, you know, that is planters from the southern colonies, merchants from Philadelphia, and sort of fishermen or other types of merchants, artisans in Boston area, New England. It provided a network for them. They could meet and discuss things, get to know each other before things deeper and more sort of divisive discussions about religion or politics would take place outside the lodge in such organizations as the Sons of Liberty and then ultimately, say, in the Continental Congress, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Still, after so many of the founding fathers were Freemasons, why is it that as we move into the 1830s did President John Quincy Adams call the fraternity a seed of evil?
Well, I think part of the popularity of the fraternity, especially with the knowledge that George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, other founding fathers were Freemasons, that Freemasonry then became a means, one organization one would join if they wished to ascend the sort of social and economic ladder in post-revolution early American society. So Freemasonry, from, say, the 1780s through the 1820s, became a place where a lot of ambitious men joined. And those ambitious men were not necessarily fully indoctrinated or not really well-mannered gentlemen, and Freemasonry grew probably beyond its capacity to absorb and properly train these men. And by the 1820s, you had, especially as the country expanded west out to the Ohio country, Indiana, Illinois, and through the south into Alabama, Mississippi, you were having more and more sort of rough and frontier men who were joining the lodges and creating lodges. And this led to a lot of confusion and consternation within the fraternity. This is the same sort of thing that was going on in America in general. That is, the East Coast, Eastern Seaboard states had a lock on most of the political power in this country until Andrew Jackson out of Tennessee was elected president. This caused all sorts of fear and worry that some rough Westerner was going to become president of the United States and, you know, bring about a rabble into our country. And so Freemasonry got individual Freemasons who thought too much about the fraternity, thought it was greater than it ought to be, expected greater privilege or power or access because they thought that Freemasonry provided these things, really got out of hand and tried to attempt and sometimes did really foolish and stupid things that were beyond the scope of what the fraternity meant to be, consequently leading to what was known as the Morgan Affair, which caused the anti-Masonic party to develop in this country, which leads to John Quincy Adams to consider the fraternity as something of an evil nature and insidious towards democracy.
So what you're saying is this was more of a internal factional issue and not necessarily the fact that the fraternity espoused a universal tolerance of religion or freedom of thought.
Right, yeah. So there's always this delicate balance in any kind of democracy or any kind of organization that while you have a set of principles that a party or an organization may espouse and support, you often, of course, get a large variety of opinion about what those principles mean. This is especially true both in the Republican Democratic Party today. You have left-wing Democrats, moderate right-wing Democrats, and same in the Republican Party. And then the question is discipline. Well, various parties or other organizations can impose a discipline or cast people out of, decide that they need to leave the party if they espouse something too radical within the platform. Freemasonry in the 1800s, early 1800s, 1810s, 1820s, this is a voluntary organization. There are grandmasters and state organizations that are trying to control this, but it's a wide open society in general. So while, say, in New York State, you may have men who, in New York City, who have a definitive and a specific idea of what Freemasonry is and act accordingly, out in the western part of the state, near Buffalo, you have men who have a completely different idea of what the fraternity is about and its secrets and its rituals, and there's not a strong way to impose discipline or to monitor such goings on.
I understand.
And so this causes a lot of confusion, and since Freemasonry has never established a national governing body, there is no Grand Lodge of the United States. Each state is a sovereign unto itself. There's no way to really coordinate or impose in certain sort of discipline or oversight.
I understand. So as we push out of the 1830s into the 1850s and 60s, would it be an accurate statement to say that the Civil War tried and reaffirmed the core beliefs of the of Freemasonry?
Yeah, I think so. I think part of what you find prior to the Civil War in the 1840s and 50s, there was a general understanding that the country was headed towards disaster over the issues of slavery and other things related to the power of the federal government versus states' rights. Freemasonry grew on its own way after the 1840s because of Western expansion and the development of economic and industrial power in larger cities. And as the Civil War approached, Freemasonry actually was better off or prospered out of the Civil War because for two reasons. One, it didn't have a national organization to be divided as states tried to succeed from the Union. And more especially, most military regiments were recruited and developed within the state. So you have, volunteer regiments out of Ohio or Alabama or whatever, and Masons in those states are volunteering and serving in those regiments, which causes them to create lodges within those regiments, and that provides an easy means for Masonic fellowship and brotherly love to occur within regiments, and then as these regiments from the North and South obviously fight each other, Freemasonry is recognized as a means to overcome these very harsh political and violent differences, and Masons help each other across these lines, North and South. And that those demonstrations of brotherly love, the charity amongst brethren, inspires more and more men to join. And, I could give you a specific example of that if you'd like.
Exactly. And I understand from your book and reading your book that there are any numerous and dramatic and inspiring examples of men on the battlefield from opposite sides recognizing and helping each other in what can only be referred to as very charitable and brotherly ways.
Yes. A good example, which unfortunately I could not fit in my book, was the story of Elijah Hunt Rhodes, who is a very famous diarist and who wrote a lot of letters during his whole service in the Civil War. He was from Rhode Island, and he served from day one through the end, and he was at every major battle just about on the Eastern Seaboard. His father and his uncle were Freemasons. He joined the Army when he was 19, but when he was after the Battle of Gettysburg, he witnessed a Masonic funeral for a Confederate soldier on the battlefield of Gettysburg, and that inspired him. And when he had leave after the Battle of Gettysburg, he went back home to Rhode Island and became a Mason there. And then after the Civil War, he remained extremely active in Freemasonry and was later Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Rhode Island.
Fascinating. Yeah. Following the conclusion of the Civil War, through the end of the century and into the 1920s, what was Freemasonry's role in helping to build and shape the communities in the United States? And then what led to its dramatic growth from the 1930s onward?
Okay. Well, the period just after the Civil War, from about 1865 to about 1910, is often called the Golden Age of Fraternalism. And during that time, not only Freemasonry, but hundreds and hundreds of other fraternal organizations were developed and established in this country, such organizations as the Grange for Farmers, Knights of Pythias, the Woodsmen of the World, the Knights of Labor, or Ancient Order United Workmen. There's hundreds and hundreds of organizations, each catering to different elements or different parts of society. This also includes a lot of ethnic organizations for this huge amount of immigrants who are coming in, so Sons of Norway, the Greek Catholic Union, Polish Falcons, these sort of organizations. The United States, between 1870 and 1920, or approximately just before the Civil War, changed dramatically. I mean, millions and millions of immigrants came to this country, primarily from Europe. You have the Transcontinental Railroad. You have the expansion and the development of the West, not only on the West Coast, but in the middle states of Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado. You have huge industrial systems are created and industries, Carnegie Steel, you know, Rockefeller and his oil, Pullman and railroads, and places like Cincinnati become, you know, Porkopolis, and Chicago, you know, has a great slaughterhouses and industrial, and Pittsburgh, of course, becomes the leading manufacturer still. All these rapid changes cause a lot of confusion and a lot of instability in society. Freemasonry and then the other fraternal organizations that develop as a reflection of Freemasonry provides us the stability needed in society. That is, a man who works by day, who grew up on a farm or in a small village, by the time he's 40 or 50 in the 1870s or 80s, he's now living in a city filled with soot and crime and dirt and strange things. And he's working probably more in a factory than in an office. His life is changing rapidly with the advent of telephones and later the electric light and, you know, these sort of things. And the fraternity provides a place of stability and quiet and charity during these times of change. You have to remember, this is before Social Security, before labors, before child labor laws, before really life insurance for the most part, and any kind of protection of workers from being killed or injured on the job. So the lodge and its ritual provides this sort of security and stability within the private lodge, and then the brothers of the lodges and the lodge system itself is providing relief in time of accident or trouble or disaster to look after widows and orphans and this sort of stuff.
And we're back to the issue of creating networks of individuals, in this particular instance men, who've traveled from one experience to the other and are looking to reaffirm the values and the principles that they know best.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so part of what you have is you also have to remember that a huge percentage of men and their families are not just immigrating from overseas, but they're migrating off the East Coast out to the West and Southern West. So you have a lot of men who are sort of educated and professionals on the East Coast who then go and to a city or a middle-sized city in the Midwest, and they're establishing colleges and schools and their churches, and they're also establishing lodges to provide some sort of culture or refinement out on the wilderness. And then, of course, they're continually in correspondence back with their families on the East Coast, and they may be able to take a train ride back. And so the country is becoming further and further formed together, and so corporations, businesses are no longer just selling locally. They're selling regionally and ultimately into national markets. And so you have the rise of, you know, a national corporation like Standard Oil, who's going to sell oil or refine oil for everybody in the country. Mm-hmm. This sort of infrastructure and this development creates, of course, a larger and larger middle class, so those managers and executives and accountants and businessmen and engineers, and that, again, provides a network for men to join, and part of Freemasonry is helping develop that network of men across state and regional boundaries.
Mm-hmm. With as large as the fraternity is, and what was the high point of the fraternity? How large did it become?
Well, I think the numerical peak of Freemasons, that's the maximum number of men that have been Freemasons, occurred about 1960 with 4 million men. But the largest percentage of eligible men who were Masons, that is the percentage of the population or the percentage of eligible men, that is about 12%, which is about 1928-29, just before the Great Depression. So the development of the Freemasonry in 1900 had less members, about 900,000 in 1900. The Odd Fellows, which was more of a working class organization, had about 1 million members. It was Odd Fellows had more members, but by 1920 and 1930, Freemasonry had surpassed the Odd Fellows. In fact, the Odd Fellows and a lot of middle class working class organizations were declining rapidly. This is primarily due to the rise of the middle class, of an affluent suburban middle class who could afford the dues and the requirements of Freemasonry. And so Freemasonry really took off after 1900, and then, of course, a huge percent joined when the United States entered World War One. And then that, as the prosperity of the 20s really took off after 1921, Freemasonry just grew leaps and bounds. I think by 1900, they had about 1 million members. By 1930, they had about 3.5 million.
And today, with so many men still being part of the fraternity, I'm sure that if you went to the average person on the street, their first thought might be that they don't know anyone who ever was a Freemason. What's our response to something like that?
Well, there's probably a good chance that they happen to know somebody who is a Freemason, or somebody in their family probably was, a grandfather, great grandfather, great uncle, somebody like that. They're just not aware of it. And again, this is the rapid change in American society in the last 40, 50 years, and just things are forgotten or mislaid. There's certainly what Richard Nixon called the silent generation or the silent majority. A healthy generation of men, particularly sort of what's called the greatest generation who fought in World War II, but also the generation who fought in Korea, a little younger, they weren't really good at communicating what Freemasonry was to their children, their grandchildren, and other people. And there wasn't a lot of publicity done, or public relations really done after 1960.
So, in fact, if the average person would ask, they'd probably find that their father, their uncle, certainly their grandfather was, in fact, a Freemason.
Yeah, and this is true for myself. I didn't know. I only got interested in Freemasonry about 10 years ago, and I didn't really think anybody in my family was a Freemason until my aunt told me that my great-grandfather was a Freemason in South Dakota back about 1910. But I had no idea of that until very recently.
Mm-hmm. And then not only our founding fathers, but throughout history, prominent Americans have been Freemasons as well.
Yes, that's true. But, you know, for every well-known Freemason you can think of, like, say, Harry Truman, there are certain also important Freemasons, important Americans who were not Freemasons, such as Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Edison.
Mm-hmm. Have popular fictions such as The Da Vinci Code and movies such as National Treasure, have they helped or hurt Freemasonry?
Well, I think it's helped. I think that at this point in time, because there's so many misconceptions and just lack of information on Freemasonry, any kind of publicity is good at this point. The question really before the fraternity and before Masons is whether or not the fraternity is going to provide correct answers to the fiction that's being purported. So something like National Treasures, that movie is a very good movie for Freemasonry, and it reveals a lot of things about Freemasonry within that if it's watched closely. But we just have to be careful, and Freemasons have to be specifically careful not to perpetuate this idea that somehow Freemasons are in possession of a huge treasure of material things, or that we are descended from Egypt or from Knights Templarism or this sort of stuff. We need to get and stick to the facts and get back to the basic mission. I would hate to think that some man wants to join Freemasonry because he thinks he's going to get access to some sort of hidden hoard of wealth, or that he thinks that he's going to join some sort of secret brotherhood that his job it is to defend society in such a way, it would cause confusion.
So Freemasonry isn't the New World Order?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's beyond that comprehension. You wouldn't even be able to figure out how to do that, since there's so much diversity and so much division, as far as there's no one sovereign authority in Freemasonry in this country or any place else.
Uh-huh. After three centuries of men being drawn toward the fraternity, is it still relevant in the 21st century?
Well, I think it very much so is, and in fact it's becoming more relevant, again, because in the last 40 years since the 1960s and the turmoil of the 60s and more especially the 70s, there's been a lot of confusion in the society, and a lot of what was presumed to be the right way to live or the expected way to live and society would operate has been turned over in many cases in religion and politics and morality and for better or worse, and certainly the advent of suburbia and tourism and travel and consumer culture, a lot of things continue to change, and most things we assumed was assumed 30, 40 years ago is now some places not allowed. I mean, growing up, I grew up in Iowa, and when I was a kid, you know, we sang Christmas carols at school services or school programs.
Mm-hmm.
Today, just the whole idea of using the term Christmas makes people nervous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These sort of things have caused a great deal of confusion in society, and we see a lot of sort of the mainstream Protestant or denominations losing membership, while we see a lot of sort of younger, more strict or literal denominations of Christianity growing in strength. Freemasonry has an opportunity to provide a certain stability, as it did in times of confusion, where we have specific things we ask of brothers, we have certain discipline, but we have the opportunity to meet men and provide fellowship across all these boundaries that may confuse and cause otherwise confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Such as, you know, in a time when you have strident liberals and strident conservatives, Freemasonry can provide an opportunity for those extreme left or extreme right men to meet as men and as brothers in a lodge. Or different religious convictions, Freemasonry can provide that opportunity for those men of different religious convictions or race or creed or anything else in a lodge. And the question is whether or not Freemasonry is going to provide that opportunity and encourage that kind of, not diversity, but finding a commonality amongst diverse people.
Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, we could say principles, values, charity, brotherhood, equality, a place where men of like minds and dissimilar backgrounds can meet.
Yes, and I think this is really important, because the problem that happens in this country, and we see it continually, is that different competing factions for political power, social power, economic power are accusatory towards their rivals. We understand, or we should understand or remember, that, say, the extreme left or the extreme right in this country both believe are good, patriotic Americans who want their best for their families and best for their communities. They just have different agendas about how they wish to bring them about. Men who uphold certain moral principles, regardless of their political or religious or economic agenda, should be able to come together and lodge. This is what the founding principle of Freemasonry was back in the 1700s. It's important to remember that Freemasonry grew in London after a time where Europe had suffered 300 years of religious wars. There were fierce political revolutions like the English Civil War. You know, the king had been executed a few decades before. There was rebellion in Scotland, and then the new, the George of Hanover and the first Hanoverian kings started in England. And so Freemasonry was established in part to bring men who might otherwise be bitter enemies, based on some sort of religious or political background, as brothers within a lodge. This is extremely important today.
Mark, did Freemasonry serve as a template or outline for other organizations or fraternal groups in the past?
Oh, very much so. In fact, the book that I wrote, American Freemasons, Three Centuries of Building Communities, is specifically aimed and attempting to explain that very notion. It's my argument that Freemasonry, being the oldest and probably the longest continuous volunteer association in this country, while sometimes directly impacted or created other organizations and sometimes indirectly. So, for an example, B'nai B'rith for Jewish Americans was founded in part by Jewish Freemasons in the United States, and many of the things that in Freemasonry was borrowed to create B'nai B'rith. This is also true with something like the Grand Army of the Republic, which is the first veterans organization for Union veterans after the Civil War, that was founded by Freemasons, and a lot of the elements, including ritual and password and secret grip, were part of the Grand Army of the Republic. But also indirectly, such as the Knights of Columbus for American Catholic men, Knights of Columbus wasn't founded by Freemasons, but the Knights of Columbus borrow a lot of elements that were first organized and created within Freemasonry to create the Knights of Columbus. Even such organizations later on as, say, the Rotary Club. Rotary International is not founded by Freemasons, but they take certain elements of Freemasonry to create a community service business organization. Freemasonry does not encourage business and does not have the means for men to exchange business cards and to mutually support each other economically, but Rotary provides that opportunity in local clubs. So Freemasonry, in fact, I would argue, is the inspiration or the model or the template for most of what we understand to be volunteer associations in this country. Even trade unions, ethnic organizations, certainly college fraternities and sororities, just about any kind of community service organization or volunteer organization in this country has a Masonic element in it, either directly or indirectly.
Excellent. Well, Mark, it is a fascinating book, and if I may say so, a lavishly illustrated book. Again, Mark Tabbert, the author of American Freemasons, Three Centuries of Building Communities. Mark, if individuals listening today on our podcast would like a copy of your book or would like more information on Freemasonry in particular, where should they go?
I would suggest that they could visit my museum's website, which is monh.org, Museum of Our National Heritage. More information on the book could be found on NYU Press, New York University Press, which was a co-publisher. And then I would just simply suggest for people who want to learn more about Freemasonry, they just do a search on the Internet for, say, Grand Lodge of their state, and that will give them the most immediate information about where they live.
Mark, thank you again so much. It's been a fascinating discussion. Again, for theflypod.com, this is your host, John Cutter.